Blog Talk Radio.
What would you make of that? Besides raising an eyebrow and being a bit skeptical, because what we would be looking at is an abstraction, wouldn't we? Somebody is defining wisdom for us, or to create a framework, and then bringing it down into its elements. It works. It works very well if we are thinking about masonry along the same lines or consistent with the way we would think about mathematics. Only we wouldn't be saying that you're going to become, we're going to create a course that is going to produce another Richard Feynman. Yeah? We're not going to do that. But we will say, you know, we're going to stimulate the appetite of people that enjoy that kind of clarity and can build on it. That there's a certainty to it, isn't there, where once you learn it, once you have the facts, I say advisedly, then you can move on. And everything was moving along so beautifully until Feynman comes along with this quantum theory. It's like Einstein came. Everything is moving along very fine, and then Archimedes came along, and then the adventure of thought just makes us pause. And so now, I would think the world's mathematicians know the need to ridicule the rest of us because we haven't achieved a firm understanding of quanta. But it doesn't interrupt their progress, the progress of their calculations and their understanding, and it certainly doesn't interrupt the discussions at that level. At that level, and thank goodness, I would say, it would be healthier in some way if we could address Freemasonry with a similar kind of a mindset that. We may be, I'm not saying we're all Archimedes. No, we're not doing that. Or no, we're not being written up like with the controversy of Pythagoras. No, we're not going to do that. But we are, there are some things that we can learn from what's happened and how mathematics affects us and develops and its centrality in the universe. And day by day when I wake up, I don't immediately think about the mathematics around the larger mathematical challenges that are looming, but they are there. Nevertheless, I can sleep well at night with that assumption. They are there. That science is there. And there are efforts being made to discover, to extract patterns and certainties. You say that, and then you immediately think about the probability. Huh? How much certainty is there? And then knowing that there will be a lot of folks that will claim, well, not so much a lot of folks. There will be those types of people who will say, huh, if you can't guarantee me your ability to predict the future, it doesn't exist. It's invalid. If you sleep well at night, I'm not going to disturb that. If you sleep well, convinced that you can predict tomorrow, I'm not going to challenge that. Good on you. Good. There's some flaws in your logic. And it doesn't necessarily matter to you, and it certainly is not. It's not on my shoulders or anybody else to persuade you otherwise, to impose. Nevertheless, in the broader discussions, having the sense that you're clairvoyant. Really does put us in the category of what of what clairvoyance or understanding the the mathematics and errors in assumption, like the idea that there's some predictability flipping a coin. Well, we're re-examining those assumptions, and we're finding new things all the time, new understandings. But I don't know if the right word is they're lost to us. They remain in the background or on that dusty academic shelf until we begin to ask the questions. When we do that, not only does the nature of the question define us, or whether we ask questions on this level or not, what the nature of those questions are, even in their innocence, it's all good. it defines us, whether we ask questions or don't ask questions. It is the triggering mechanism in a way for that political conversation to take place. Politic being that overriding discussion that goes on in the background around us all the time. It's very important. We have to be able to communicate, and we batter it around. Oh my goodness, it's a little chip of insight on a great big tumultuous ocean that is quite temperamental. And we come along wanting to look in and understand what we can from that chip of insight. So the masonry contains that and I think a beautiful kind of it's almost like an indictment in a way. If you take this on, you're never going to understand it fully. Well, that's clear. That's determinism, isn't it? At its finest. Who am I to say that? And what proof do I have that is a valid thing to say, or is it just conjecture? You know, is it just me spinning something out of thin air? There's a lot of that going on. Fortunately, we're given an opportunity to learn and understand logic and reasoning. We always have it. That natural state of masonry where the ideas begin to just connect, where there's synchronicity, is present, but in the same way, I think, as mathematics. If you aren't asking the questions, what benefit, we'll all benefit from that knowledge, or we'll all be impacted by that knowledge, whether we ask the question or not. Too often, these wonderful ideas they're kidnapped by folks that want to see a way of using them for their own advantage. We are become death, you know that quote. But this is an uplifting show, and we want to be frank as we need to, and turn our sights to the next question that's coming up. This idea that there might be some collective consciousness about masonry, I think it's there and it's quite evident to us that we identify. And at its simplest level, you know, when I was a boy, you would see us with a slide rule in our pocket, and that would identify, those are the geeks, those are the nerds. Now I don't even know if I still have a slider around here. It's like it's not necessary. You can do these computations with a function on my smartphone. I don't even have to go near my desk and desktop computer anymore. Oh, things are moving and beautifully so. The imagination, well, you know, those of us who were fascinated by the stories of Jules Verne and science fiction are seeing these things starting to be implemented, starting to become real, starting to be, the fantasy is becoming reality. So what holds us back? We could all say with some legitimacy, imagination. So let's apply a bit of imagination to what we do as freeborn masons. Scratch our heads and start to ask what in the world that is so that I can answer it more fully. I don't think we approach this with any degree of precision. We approximate it. We approximate. If you're in earnest, and are you a philosopher at heart. Well, we can redefine the philosophical nature of a person without them necessarily being aware. Let's wonder about the collective consciousness of Masons, but I think we'd all have to accept that our modes of recognition are the easiest secret that we have. Once you learn them. Oh, that other part, can we learn to control our emotion? Can we be discreet? Can we make it be the effort of diplomacy? Well, that's a horse of a different color, as the wizard said. No, we're moving and we never stop. And the sense of reality and looking around and you sit there and tell me that all that I see is it could be illusion. And instead of order and predictability from that order, there's chaos and this sense of consciousness where you and I can open our eyes, sense the disorder, and begin to, what word do you use, rationalize? Begin to explain it, and explain it into terms that makes sense to this mind that we carry around with us. And how do we know that? Oh, deep questions. Better to have that kind of conversation when you're in the mood. And there are people that are never in the mood, and that's perfectly fine. It's live long and prosper, Spock. The world is learning more and more about itself, and it's, you know, in some ways it becomes a great big neighborhood where we have some shitty little things going on way over there, and they're thinking there's a shitty little things way over here, and we're right. We need to be able to communicate those ideas. And if we're all clamoring to be on top, what happens when we're all on top? and then it's not a matter of whether the sacrifice is worth it. We seem driven. And we can motivate ourselves saying, this is fear-based. I'm doing this in retaliation to the nastiness that's out there, to the perceived threat. And that's just what it is. Oh, yeah, trees fall in the forest. And if I'm standing underneath one, it could fall on me. But it hasn't. It hasn't yet. Bad things do happen. But to reorganize an entire worldview based on that supposition seems a little bit, what's the word that you would use here? Demeaning? Trivial? There's so much more happening around that, the perception of threat and the worry and the whether we become we tip into paranoia, it's always there. Sure, it can happen to anyone for lots of reasons. A head injury, a flu, a virus, a disease. There's lots of ways that the brain can be affected by this whole process. Masonry comes along. Is it in some way a salve? Is it a way of organizing that those thoughts that are going on around us? How do I make sense of this? Or can I even admit to anybody that I wake up and I have this need, the more and more I examine it, to just understand the connection? Well, you realize quite quickly that if your mindset is bleak, then your results will probably be bleak. Confirmation bias, I think they call it. We have a lot of bias. I think they identify about a dozen of the little rascals right now. Confirmation bias, yeah. I like what I like. I want to believe what I want to believe. Well, and then that means that there is this dualism. Here I have this very simple, comforting belief, whether it's factual or not. And out there is this objective sensibility. And do I look at things objectively? Well, there's the rub. It's fascinating when you can begin to learn that. Remember, you're taught that, not the process, but taught the language, so that you're able to describe these thought processes. And do you remember it was hellish? Somebody talking. I remember somebody talking to me about abstract reasoning. I don't have no idea, but then when I began to understand what it was like, well, if this silly sod had talked with me about what it was, then I could have given him, or I wouldn't have been so alarmed. Like, what is this? You know, it seems so hard. Well, it's not hard at all. It's really not that hard at all. We make things more difficult until we begin to ask the questions and control the emotion. Why is my set point irritation? When I don't understand something, well, I went through some experiences and reminders again this week with a bunch of fellows and very irritable with each other and saying silly things about one another. And I'm reminded that the people that are indifferent don't talk like that. They just don't care. This is an effort. What we're seeing is an effort at an investment. Something is important, and they don't necessarily have an overarching narrative. Well, they don't have to. Somebody else can offer that kind of insight. They don't necessarily have to be diplomatic about their beliefs. But when I think about it, when you think about it, if what they're striving for has something to do with harmony, living in harmony, not necessarily in your own head, but with other people, and having a sense of being of contributing to that, well, that requires a considerable contribution. Given willingly, I don't agree with people that tell me that what we are in this order are volunteers. We're not volunteers. No, we are dedicated. We are pilgrims. Is a pilgrimage a volunteer kind of a process? If you talk to people at nearing the end of the pilgrimage, you might be surprised or not surprised at what they would say. Is it voluntary, or do you have this drive, this need, this question, this doubt? I'm looking around for the address of the Delphic Oracle. I know she's out there, but I can't find the address as much as I look. Now, a lot of people are telling me, you know, here, this is it. They just misspell it a little bit and they try and sell it to me. Well, we said a little bit of misdirection, eh? You be the judge for yourself. And with all of your doubts and all of your difficulties, that's the norm. And that's what's going on around us all the time. And understanding that, well, it's, I guess we could throw our hands in the air and run around with our hair in flames, or we could say, deep breath. This is normal, huh? So that story of the Buddha and his protected childhood and his journey out, is seeing the dire circumstance of people an existence that he didn't know before, and then being humbled and troubled, and then reaching a state of understanding. The challenge. I'm inclined to think that I'm never going to have answers for things, but I like to think that I'm part of an order that brings a bit of dignity to not knowing. In a world where people are ready to wag their finger at me and you and tell us things about ourselves, whether they know us or not. I think there's much to be had by exercising some character. The hard part when somebody's screaming and they're very angry and upset, listening to them. Oh, that can be hard until you learn how to do it. It can be very, very difficult. Person's upset. They need an outlet. Well, great. You know, I can be that outlet if it helps them get through the night. But underneath that, there's something else going on. And if those folks need to get it off their chest and talk about it, well, at least I can offer a helping hand. Simply acknowledge their worldview, their point of view, and move along. And that's exactly what we're going to do right now. The commentary today is, it's a bit bleak. I've titled it Discovery. But if you'll bear with me, we get into some beautiful, beautiful poetry with the eighth sonnet by William Shakespeare. It just fills your lungs with oxygen. It's just, it's one of those, I didn't know that. Yeah, now that you mention it, it's one of those kind of things. And now what I'm going to mention is about Dave Brubeck. Don't worry about me. Good to have you. Sit back, relax. Thank you. That'll have to do. Good start. Discovery. Do you mind a word about this? Discovery. Just a way of thinking. Observations. You have them. I have them. It's no coincidence Freemasonry causes men to be aware and rethink. No. It's no force of nature, but it acts as if it were. Over there where it first took root, times were different. I don't know if the men were different. Generations on, whether Eastern or Western, it appears men have been able to pick up on similarities. Selling out loyalty to the tribe. The only uniformity we find is struggle. We want you to acquire Masonry, but do so with respect that your culture, your history, and social climate is altogether unique, as is ours. By exposing you to idealistic notions of achievement, we enlist the truthful supplications of remain of our boyhood as a stepping stone to an expanded mindscape. My goodness. Be cautious. It will take you out of whatever you call a comfort zone. Superstition will be romanticized. It should. History will become personal. And you will be encouraged to scratch away at the edges of calculus and philosophy at your own pace. Perfectly in balance for you. In balance for you. It's not a competition. It's an acknowledgement, isn't it? Everybody gets their due. Merit. Merit doesn't come by what other people say. It's what we do with it. When we recognize somebody has an ability or a talent. Well, my grandfather used to say, you know, better than some, worse than others. Habit is made into commitment. Commitment alters thinking. Presence of mind implies we grab ideals and imagination and begin interpreting them. Ideals becoming sources of motivation to act upon our world. Our language takes on new meanings. The compressions of a good life in ritual are accelerating, and sources of motivation to act on the world. Compressions are accelerating and expanding. Your participation exposes you to those exertions. So prepare to lose your footing. Hesitance leaves us. We settle on the knowledge we think we deserve or what we believe is within our capability, risking our real potential will remain dormant. So many, a man in so many stages of their own development, yet finding common purpose at the most superficial, essential level, joining over a meal, absorbing all the psychology, the psychological elements, and being aware at the time any of them are in play, being unaware, yeah. Do we discover or acquire or invent masonry for ourselves. Doesn't it? But I'm busy. Doesn't matter. Why ask such silly questions? My goodness. Except we can be all that we are and trace in our own mind that pilgrimage to definitions, to understanding our the way that we express ourselves, our behaviors tell us in exquisite detail about our values and principles, not as we want them to be, but as they are, as the world sees us. Does it matter? Well, it oughta. It's a little Chet Baker. Thank you. If you could have dinner with just anyone of your choosing throughout history, who would it be? Be the father who died when you were an infant? Would it be Napoleon? Would it be Chaucer? Would it be a thinker from the past? Maybe it would be Socrates. Or would it be perhaps William Shakespeare, 16th century poet? Would it be a poet? Wouldn't that be interesting? And if you could have this choice once, let's just say you couldn't have it a second time. But today we're going to present this part of the show as if your choice was this 16th century poet, William. Smart guy, well-read, huh? When we speak about him, when he's spoken about, again, it's like a lot of things. This doesn't conquer the world. We're not into that authoritarian state of mind. You know, this is what you must do. No, this is choices you make based on ability and interest and curiosity. But when we speak about William Shakespeare, he's in such interesting company. My goodness, we speak about Homer and Dante and Tolstoy and Dickens. This is we talk about his contemporaries, like Ben Jonson. My goodness, he said Shakespeare was not of an age, but for all time. Well, yeah. Yeah. What's interesting is that this guy, you think about it, a smart person could have done a lot of things, could have gone into the business and made a profit, lived that way. But he chose a different path. He was a writer. And what he did was, I don't know if I could say it's unprecedented, but it is in some ways very, very defining. He has the qualities that other writers had, but he has a keenness, a sensibility that that he applied to human beings and their complete range of emotion and conflicts. There was this is like real life, your soul being put on display through a storyline. This is like the truth of the fool in the king's court. This is that you could sit at arm's length and examine pathos that in your heart you know is part of the human condition. But I'm safe. I'm not. It's not me right now. I can observe it. This is the tragedy. Somebody else's tragedy. Oh, never mind. Until it's mine. Until it's my turn. He had an energy, didn't he? And he applied it to human situations with an uncanny insight. How does he understand that? Well, he wasn't all those things. He wasn't a general. He wasn't Richard II. He was William, but he was an observer, and he could take observations and expand on them into the human context by thinking that if this if I can see this, then this must apply to the world around me. And so he wasn't right. It was the accuracy and depth and wow, the sensitivity, the compassion, the authenticity of his work. It's still with us today, and I know I get people get tired of listening to me talk about it, but I'm quite convinced that Masonic ritual deserves that level of scrutiny, of study. He didn't go he didn't go on to university. He was studying. He studied classical. We can tell he was well read. Well, he was self-directed. He learned to read and write, and he started off with Latin studies. That was commonplace in the day for his social level, but he didn't go on to university, and it's unlikely that the that he would have found much interest in logic and rhetoric and other what would you call them, organized courses. He got married late in life, 18 years old. But we know a little bit about him, but just enough, and we clamor for more. This is a poem. This is a sonnet, a poem that is written to the young man. Now, a lot of his work was written. The sonnets were written to. It was noticed that they were written as if speaking to a young man or to a young man and about a young man. And then after a time, he was writing to a young woman. And that in itself, you have to wonder, does anybody ever wonder why or how? Yeah, well, yeah, a lot. But how in the world are you ever going to know? Except we can deduce quite a bit. Getting on with things, I looked at my dusty old copy of Shakespeare's work, and what caught my eye was Sonnet 8. And this is addressed to the mysterious young man that he writes to so often in his sonnets. And it's full of, it's put in three quatrains and couplet, and it gives an argument for the old man to go out with women and enjoy his life. So the narrator is using the young man's lack of joyfulness while listening to music as a metaphor for the young man's affairs. There are hints to the harmony of a family and how the young man, he's still single and he doesn't exactly follow that family lifestyle. The young man advice to give up on the single life and start his path toward companionship, as if an older, more experienced man wants that comfort, wants to share that happiness with this young fellow who seems sad. So we're going to hear the metaphor. Music used as a metaphor. Why hearest thou music sadly? He asks. See what you think. Eh? See what you think. You, for yourself, you like music to listen to, so why does listening to music make you sad? Delightful and joyful things should complement one another, so why do you love things that make you unhappy and enjoy things that are bad for you? If music played well and in tune sounds bad to you, it's because the music is rebuking you for not playing your own part, for not making your own harmony by getting married and having children. And notice how the sound of two strings vibrating together in harmony is like a father and a child and a happy mother who all sing one pleasing note together. And the music doesn't have words. It's the unity of their voices that sings this warning to you. If you stay single, you be a childless nobody. Ha. Here. Music to hear. Why hearest thou music sadly? Sweets with sweets war not. Joy delights in joy. So lovest thou that which thou receivest not gladly, or else receivest with pleasure thine annoy? If the true concord of well-tuned sounds by unions married do offend thine ear, they do but sweetly chide thee, who confounds in singleness the parts that thou should bear. Mark how one string, sweet husband to another, strikes each other in each by mutual ordering, resembling sire and child and happy mother. who all in one pleasing note do sing, whose speechless song being many, seeming one, sings this to thee, thou single will prove none. Do you get it? Says something, huh? Just says something. Now, what it says? Oh, my goodness. What do you take from it? Who's he, you know? Who's he to tell anybody this? Well, he's William Shakespeare. What is he saying? And do you and I take it as an order or a directive or a judgment, or is it descriptive? My goodness, he endures. What are we now? 500 years later? Thank you. Why dost thou listen to joyful music so sad? Yeah, it's a good question there. Thanks, William, for asking it. Some people don't find music at all appealing, or they have a taste for one thing and they close the book. That's enough. I like that. It's to my way of thinking, it's like taking up an artist's palette and only putting one color paint on it. Oh, I don't have a big argument or a pushback. It's, isn't that interesting? Maybe their rainbows only have one hue, one tone. We're revisiting some bits of our history that tell us about pressure points and things that I think, in a way, make us more responsive and understanding of the guidance that is given to us in masonry. Here, we've been talking about Leiden in the Netherlands and what was going on because at the time, this is the 18th century, early 18th century, masonry was doing well in a Protestant Britain, and Protestantism was very stable in the Netherlands, not so much in France and Spain at the time, as we know. That did not exonerate masonry from tensions. And as we learned in the last episode, the clergy became quite concerned about this rumor that Masons were playing cards and were using the devil cards, being the term used loosely for tarot, divination. And the church was not having any of that. None of that was going to happen on their watch. So there was persecution. And we know from the records that one lodge was actually fining Masons for playing cards too much. They weren't having any of this fortune telling or magic. And for a time, they were attacked by both the Protestant and Catholic clergy because the power attributed to them implied that fate and fortune, not divine providence, ruled over human affairs. Fate and fortune, like probability? Anyway, at this point, we're fortunate to be able to recreate something of the atmosphere of the controversy. Pamphlets were published on both sides, and petitions to the civil and ecclesiastical authorities were filed by the Freemasons and their clerical detractors. We were doing this through the system. In nearby Arnheim, a female cousin of the excluded brothers privately appealed to one of them not to continue in the struggle with the local clergy because, as her manuscript letter explains, only he would be the loser. Luckily, this personal plea has been preserved. It tells us a great deal about what it must have felt like to live in one of those towns and to be in the eye of the storm between traditional religiosity and the new and imported secular society. The cousin writes, "Whole country is full of it. Yesterday I was in the shop near us. Oh, it was the Freemasons now and the Freemasons once again. The old woman who sits there in the shop says there was nothing else to talk about. Clearly this strange import, not simply from abroad, but also by 1750 from enlightened circles within the Republic, violated everyday assumptions about how men should behave. We get an inkling of what was being said about the Freemasons from hearing the charges repeated by this concerned and by no means naive relative. She has no illusions about the clergy, and she notes that the Dominus is too clever for you, and he has money like water. He must have 100,000 guilders, and he lives like a bishop. In short, the clergy are very powerful, and she tells her cousin, you are placed in an untenable position. If you have the dominie around your throat and pulling on your ears, this scandal, she continues, will hurt your chances of marrying and of becoming an officer. Those who do not respect God and his law can have neither luck nor blessings. Among the interesting rumors that have spread about the Freemasons is the luxury of their meals. Here in the letter associated with French manners, which, quote, spoilt the wallet and the stomach. What this upright cousin could not have known was that other women at this time shared her concern. Indeed, French women, in this instance living in the southeastern province of Alsace, refused to marry men unless they renounced their Freemasonry. We do not know the reasons for their refusal, but we can reconstruct the thinking of one Dutch Protestant woman at mid-century as it related to this new, almost inexplicable fraternity. The luxury of Masonic manners primarily concerned our Francophone cousin. She says it is rumored that Masons eat as if they were at a wedding or a synod, clerical gathering. The association with conspicuous and excessive consumption, which we have seen before in the comments of British Freemasons about themselves, should remind us that in most parts of Western Europe, lodge meetings were gatherings of elites with some surplus income, like the military officers who frequented the lodge in the garrison town of Nijmegen. But this did not prevent, and perhaps it encouraged, wild rumors to circulate. Hence the accusations recounted in the letter. The Freemasons engaged in cursed idol worship. They pray to animals, and even can fly. This might provoke an ironic chuckle. Cousin, please don't learn to fly, she says. Yet the irony did not stop this young relative from briefly recounting a very story told by a minister about someone in a local church who, possessed by the spirit, that he hung in midair between heaven and earth. Making the point, eh? It's interesting when you want to make a point and you want to be persuasive that there's a tendency for these large institutions to find the pressure points, things that are really troubling to their congregations, and play on them. Devil worship, huh? Flight, superstition, and play on them to advance a particular viewpoint, your viewpoint. So, gee, we live in a secular world, but as I look around and pick up a newspaper, it's full of the results of religious and political collisions. I don't know if it's as much the progression of humanity as an artifact of humanity, that these discussions will always be with us. And therein lies the rub. Eh? We need to be able to comfort and connect and not ridicule and reject. And it sounds almost silly to be talking about embracing these people and their beliefs, trying to understand, listening. So that we don't slam the door on our young people just because they say something that is an affront to us. Kids have been doing that for thousands of years. And I guess in a way, as Masons, we need to be prepared for that, don't we? Here, this is a bit by a brother, Duke Ellington. Brother Duke Ellington, it's called Solitude. That's it for today. I see that we're coming to the end of the program again. Sadly, thank you for sitting in. And as you go about your business, perhaps we can remind each other that today, as ever, the world could benefit from this influence of tolerance and understanding. And as fragile and incomplete as we might be, we each understand that, and how we deploy that in our lives and around other people. Well, that's the energy, that's the purposefulness, the aim of Freemasonry. And if we can do that, if we can help people overcome that sadness and loneliness and fear, I think we can be happy about that. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope this has been entertaining and informative. I look forward to having you join us again next week. In the meantime, commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and include yourself in that charity. Bye for now.